The portfolio doctors are Dan Osgood and Stephen Bick, who are investment advisor representatives of their respective registered investment advisor firms, ACAS LLC and Cottingham Management Company LLC. The opinions expressed by the portfolio doctors and guests on this radio show are their own and do not reflect the opinions of this radio station. All statements and opinions expressed are based upon information considered reliable, although it should not be relied upon as such. Any statements or opinions are subject to change without notice. Information presented is for educational purposes only. Moreover, no listener should assume that any discussions or information presented serves as the recipient of or a substitute for personalized advice from ACAS LLC, Cottingham Management LLC, or from any other investment professional and is not intended as an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. ACAS LLC and Cottingham Management LLC are not law or accounting firms, and no portion of this presentation should be interpreted as legal, accounting, or tax advice. Information expressed does not take into account your specific situation or objectives and is not intended as recommendations appropriate for any listener. Listeners are encouraged to seek advice from a qualified tax, legal, or investment advisor to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation.
You're listening to The Portfolio Doctors on ESPN 1700. Your financial future depends on making sound investment decisions. Make sure you get accurate information and a weekly checkup from a source you can trust, Portfolio Doctors. Now, live in studio, here's Dan Osgood and Steve Bick, the Portfolio Doctors.
Welcome. Happy Friday, everyone. Seems like it's been a relatively long week, and I've been doing double duty here in the studio this week and today. My name is Dan Osgood.
I'm
half
Steve
of the
Bick.
Portfolio Doctors. Steve Bick sitting in here with me today. Well, here we go again, Steve. All-time highs.
Oh, yeah.
I believe. S&P, last I saw, was slightly over 1,900.
Yeah, there you go. Closed above that.
Pretty substantial as far as overall returns from its lows, but not that substantial as far as a year-to-date return. And it, depending on what you've been doing, you could easily be negative in a year where the S&P is up pretty minimally.
Well, yeah, it's just amazing to me. It just keeps trucking higher. I guess if there's nowhere else to go with your money, just stick with the stock market. Huh?
That sure seems to be that because, what, last week we saw rates dipping below 2.5% on the 10-year,
correct,
which is kind of the benchmark for just about everything nowadays.
Yeah.
And yeah. That
the complacency is just the thing that really just amazes me. But, you know, you've got a lot of other things going up. I know oil's been breaking out. There's the crude oil price just came across the screen, and, you know, it's over 104 now. So you're going to see a spike in your gasoline prices. We're already seeing them going up, but they're going to go up higher.
Yay.
It just broke out to the last 52-week high. So, you know, there's a lot of, you know, inflation that's we've discussed before, but that's just not taken into account by any of the central bankers around the world. They just discount both crude and the asset inflation. And so until they finally take that into account, they're assuming that inflation's really low and we'll just keep printing.
Almost non-existent according to what they're saying. At 1.5%, that really is insignificant if in fact that was a real number.
I think if you want to look at it in another way, maybe, you know, that's really the growth number, GDP growth around there,
right.
You know. So it's just amazing to me, you know, productivity, labor productivity, which was sort of the golden age of productivity from 2000 to 2012, has sort of slumped to nothing. So, you know, the velocity of money is basically non-existent. So it's right. Like the economy is just not firing. And
it's showing signs. It's almost like a out of tune engine, I guess.
Correct.
Where some parts seem to be working and firing properly, and then one piston just isn't quite working.
Yeah.
It's misfiring. And
sounds like my van.
I've driven next to you on the road. It does.
You know, you're right, Dan. The interesting part for me, though, as a business owner and an investor, and that it's almost as if you want to believe that this type of economy, this sort of stumbling, bumbling, fumbling type economy, is the norm. You know, mm-hmm. Because if it is, and I'm not saying it's great, but if it is, then at least you can plan.
Right.
And then if you can plan, then you can actually start making good investment decisions. Mm-hmm. The problem is we all know that this isn't what anyone really wants. So you know they're going to keep tinkering away to try and get to what supposedly normal is, whatever that might be. And in doing so, there's going to be some issues along the line. And it's that unknown that everyone's hesitant about really just pushing the, you know, pushing down on the accelerator.
Right, and
pedal.
I think that's why we saw, like, last year, the reality is most professional money managers, hedge funds that have their finger on the pulse typically of what's happening in the world as far as investment decisions are made. We're only up 4 to 5% for the year when the S&P was up almost 30%. And that should be a kind of warning signal right there. And then this year, they're talking all new highs, but the reality is the market's barely up at all.
Correct.
And it's been down significantly.
I know. And I tell you what, the most of these professional hedge fund managers aren't up or barely up again this year. Mm-hmm. It's an incredibly tricky investment environment. Just if you really know what you're doing, it's almost if you were just completely ignorant and you just piled into the market, you'd be doing better than if you actually put some brain power into it. Yep.
These are the times where you could easily make a case that if you just bought the S&P 500 ETF mm-hmm. for 5 basis points and basically got in, you would get almost the exact same movement as the S&P 500. You would have done really well last year. Over the last 5 years, you'd have done very well.
Yeah.
You're not panicking at any point when it shows the short-term correction.
And outside, I mean, we talked about ETFs before, and we'll just do a little rehash quickly, but there is that slippage where there's that mm-hmm. tracking error. And, you know, it can get quite magnified, actually. I've been recently buying some SLV ETF for my fund.
Silver.
That's silver. Mm-hmm. And it's supposed to track the silver price. And silver price, I think the actual underlying silver price is around about $19.50. That's the spot price on the futures market. And the ETF is at $18.78 or something like that.
Okay.
So there's 75 cent spread. Now, that SLV ETF's been around for at least 10 years, I think. So you've had that spread over 10 years. It hasn't all developed this week since I bought. Right. But it's one of those things where you can clearly see that there's the slippage.
Right. And
it's not a lot, but it adds up over time.
Right. On a percentage basis, I don't know what that adds up to, but it's that compounding thing again.
Yeah.
Any little bit that you can keep in your pocket makes a huge
difference.
Well,
I mean, it's almost 0.5%, right? Mm-hmm. So actually, no, it's not. It's almost 5%.
75 cents?
Yeah. Think about it. On $15, that would be 5%, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just above that. So call it 4. But you know, that's quite a lot.
That's substantial.
Yeah. So if you did buy the S&P, SPY, which is the ETF for the S&P 500, and you had a 4% slip or slippage, mm-hmm. which is probably not out of the realm of reality, you're still underperforming the market.
Right. You're closer.
You're closer, yeah.
And you would have to be really disciplined and just say, this is what I'm going to do, and ignore it. Ignore the bad downtimes and just say, I'm comfortable with how the S&P turns out. And you will track it close enough to where you're probably going to do pretty well over time,
which is
at a low expense.
Yeah, no, but it's pretty funny that's just buying the S&P mm-hmm. and holding it, and you're still not beating it. You're still not even keeping
right.
up.
Right.
So it just shows you, I mean, to the listeners, that just gives you an understanding of just how hard it is to just even match
right.
the S&P, let alone keep up or exceed, particularly when you're in this type of environment when it's just – there's so many unknowns. I mean, what happens when quantitative easing finally ends? What happens to Europe? What China is? Are they slowing down, or are those numbers real or not? What's going on behind the scenes in the political circles? I mean, you know, housing looks weak. Some things look strong. Some aren't. You know, what about the impact of this taxes that we've had? What about the impact of Obamacare?
Those are all unknowns that are going to be unknowns for years to come as well.
And they're all going to unfold. Mm-hmm. And so it's just amazing to me that the market just keeps trudging higher.
Nowhere else to put your money.
Exactly.
Low interest rate environment, people.
Well, that's the funny part. Okay, so it's a low interest rate environment. And I think we're going to touch more on housing and the housing market in the next section or so. But it's just amazing to me that there's not more of a tailwind for housing, if you think about it. The main driver, one of the main drivers that people make housing affordable is low interest rates. Mm-hmm. And yet you've got interest rates at ridiculously low levels.
Historically low levels.
Yeah, and housing prices just aren't really, well, they did. They ran like crazy for a couple of years, but it just seems like that market's had its time.
A year and a half ago, but that was all investor driven.
Correct.
There's these big hedge funds.
And that's
funds.
What we said all along. We said if the investors' money will dry up once the the risk reward isn't right. there anymore.
You saw the prices start inching up because the investors, and then
You needed the down. Yeah, then you needed a normal people to step in and take over, and they just haven't. They can't do it.
Well, we talked about this earlier today with Derek, and it seems like this is probably actually a good thing. If we have a nice soft year in the real estate market, that would be healthier than another double digit increase in values in real estate, because then you're creating 04, 05, 06 all over again if we have this unwarranted appreciation year
yeah,
in, year out.
Yeah, but back then you just had the ability to get
free
the loans
money.
Were just
free money.
Yeah.
Well, stick around. When we come back, we will teach you some of the secrets of Warren Buffett and why he is so successful as an investor. Welcome back. You are listening to the Portfolio Doctors, ZSPN 1700. My name is Dan Osgood.
I'm Steve Beck.
And Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. You heard of them, Steve?
Yeah. I tell you, with a name like Charlie Munger, how can you go wrong?
That's right. Well, they had their 2004 Berkshire Hathaway annual shareholder meeting.
214, you mean?
214. What did I say?
2004.
Oops, 2014.
They also had
Berkshire
a 2004
Hathaway.
One.
They did, but it was about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And basically, someone summarized, a gentleman by the name of William Smead, summarized a lot of the points that they talked. I think the way that goes is almost like a little fireside chat where the two of them just get up there and talk. And it sounds like it's a phenomenal event to go attend,
right.
And it grows every year. They basically shut down all of Omaha. And
yep.
This is why people are there. But basically, he's summarizing the five commandments of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. And we quote Warren Buffett all the time in his philosophies because they're just so tried and true, and it's hard to argue with a guy that has been as successful as he has.
Well, when you start with nothing and you end up with $50 billion, yep.
You've got some credibility that gives it to you. Well, the very first one, thou shalt not envy.
Right.
And that is based off a quote by Charlie Munger, we are way better off by not adding to a culture of envy.
Sure. So can't argue with that.
Yes.
I gotta agree. I mean, you know, that's just negative.
And like the best thing they're talking about is don't envy the returns others make.
Correct. That's
in
what
their
I'm
disciplines.
Saying.
And that's the part that we try to preach, whether it's
who cares what your neighbor's doing,
right? Calculating your own personal inflation rate, calculating what your goals are and what you need to accomplish for those goals, that's all you should worry about. It doesn't matter, because your neighbor who screams over the fence, hey, guess what, my stocks were up 30% last year, I guarantee you in 2008, when his stocks were down 40, 50, 60%, he wasn't yelling over the fence, hey, guess what? My stocks are down 40 or 50%.
No, exactly. And I'll tell you right now that he won't tell you that all his stocks are up 30%, right. Just the few that were.
Right.
There's always a lot of hidden skeletons in the closet that...
Well, they don't count if you buy them
years
before, right.
That if you don't sell, then you don't have to count the loss.
Right.
Yeah.
It's unrealized. But that's it. And a lot of these commandments that we're going to go through are a lot of what we've been talking about from day one,
mm-hmm.
is do things for yourself based on what you are trying to accomplish, and your chances of achieving those goals are
correct.
Much, much greater than listening to the neighbor and letting that influence your decision making.
Yep.
The next one, thou shall hire great.
By the way, before you even go to the next one, that's not easy to do.
What's that?
Not envy and not listen and stick to your guns.
Human
and,
nature. Just.
I mean, seriously, I think I finally mastered it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really difficult to do. It takes years and years of practice.
Yes. It is, especially when you see a year like last year.
Correct.
Where it wasn't very difficult to do well. And even if you did well and were up 15%, which is a phenomenal year in any kind of year,
yep.
You're looking going, wow. I missed out on an extra 15%.
No.
What should I do next time? It's like, stay the course and continue doing what you're doing.
Correct.
And you're probably going to be better off than trying to chase.
As an example, my fund's returns, I think last year were just under 8%, which was okay, but miles below 30.
Mm-hmm.
And this year so far, the S&P's up, call it 1.5, and I'm up 6.
Right.
So now I'm winning this time. Will I win it by the end of the year? It doesn't really matter because my strategy is not based on the stocks. Right.
And as long as your strategy and your process stays the same,
yeah,
the chance of you achieving a consistently better return is much better and not losing that. And that's, again, the biggest key.
Correct.
So
let's go to number two.
Thou shall hire great people and overtrust them.
Yeah, but now here's the question is, it's not easy to find great people.
Correct.
And a lot of times when you overtrust them, then they go off the rails.
Right, if they're not great people. And this was Buffett's quote, and this is how they came to this. They make mistakes, but we get more success overall. And there's a lot to that. I've read a number of books about effective leaders.
I agree. Definitely. Empower your people.
Right.
But
you got to make them feel a part of it, that their decisions are heard or their opinions are heard, and that allows them to do a lot more and feel a lot better and want to do better.
Yep. I absolutely agree with that. The question, Noah, is, you know, getting those good people in the first place, if you find them, hang on to them.
Right.
I mean, I just as an example, I remember one of the firms I worked for, which was a very successful consulting firm. They always had an advertisement running to hire people. Mm-hmm. And there weren't any jobs available. But they go, if we find a really good person, we're going to hire them anyway.
Create a job. Correct.
Because it's like, you just take so long to find a good person that we'll just keep interviewing every day of the week till we find someone.
Well, in this article, they refer to Jim Collins. I believe he wrote From Good to Great.
Yep.
I read that book, great book, about these people that no one really heard of, no one really knew, and the way that they got their company to kill the competition for a very sustained period of time.
Correct.
And basically the theory is get the right people on the bus,
going in the right
direction, and it's going to drive itself.
Correct.
So point number three, thou shalt view competition as the enemy of competence. We've debated about what this means.
I'm
going
to leave that to
you struggle
what the
with
heck
this.
That means.
The best I can take from this, it kind of goes back to the thou shalt not envy, is don't try to compete with other people. Do what you're doing for yourself with your own goals in mind. Don't try to compete with a neighbor. Don't try to compete with the guy at the barbershop or whoever is giving you unnecessary advice. Or unwanted advice, and you're going to do better. That's the best I can get out of this, which is very similar to point number one.
What was it again? Read it again.
Thou shalt view competition as the enemy of competence.
As the enemy of competence. So it takes away the competence because there's too much competition. So rather find, to me, what it means is try and find a moat. They always talk about that moat. Mm-hmm. Try and find get your moat around your business so that no one else can compete with you. Mm-hmm. And so maybe once you've got enough competence, the moat's created because there is no competition.
Well, that makes sense too here, because here's the quote from Charlie Munger. Don't try out for the NBA if you're 5'2" tall.
Well, unless you can get it in from halfway.
Yeah, unless you're Muggsy Bogues. He had a small, short career, no pun intended, because he was only like 5'1 or 5'2". But then it goes, to find a circle of competence, compete against idiots.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what you're saying. If you can insulate yourself from other forms of competition and create something that is unique, then competition is not there. There is no such thing as
competition. I think we finally worked out what it is.
Okay. There we go. See?
Yay.
It's all we had to do was talk about it. Number four, thou shalt value qualitative over quantitative. And then Buffett's quote was, Aesop was right. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. Fisher was qualitative in analyzing stocks. Graham was quantitative, and Charlie convinced me that Fisher is correct. Our eight criteria have a clearly qualitative bend and do not emphasize the deep value pattern of Ben Graham. We will we'll comment more. The next
week. So they looking at companies with quality versus profits.
Okay.
Wow. Because when Buffett started, he was all about Ben Graham, and that was all about the bottom line.
Yeah.
And now he's shifted to, I think this is also...
Charlie Munger's been there for a number of years, so I don't know how long ago that transformation took place.
Well, with Munger, he might have been there a little bit more before Buffett. But, this could also be a factor of... We've got so much money and so much cash flow, and we've got to deploy it, and we can't find value anymore because once we step into the ring, the price goes through the roof and value's gone.
Right.
So we better focus on something different, and we better just find quality because that'll win out in the end.
Right.
Goes back to putting the right people on the bus.
Right, and also the fact that their time horizon is so long.
Correct.
That they are investing, everything they invest in is for the long term. It is not for, wow, Correct. We think this is going to jump 25% this year, so we're going to buy it and then sell it at the end of the year.
No, they
don't do that.
And they're looking outside of just quality people, they're looking for quality of earnings.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an entirely different subject, which is, you know, how strong are the earnings? How broad is your customer base? Do you have a lot of goodwill? Do you have a lot of depreciation? Do you? And if you do, then that's really not quality earnings. Those are just fictitious numbers.
Right.
So let's just boil down to really, is this a solid business with solid numbers, solid customers, a moat around it? That's the qualities I think they're probably looking for.
And it clearly is working.
Yeah, you would think so.
Yeah. Number five, the last one, thou shalt remove ignorance from investing.
And Munger, well, that's just listen to the portfolio doctors.
That's there you go.
That's why we're here, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
He should have
called us up. We could have
given all these.
No,
we could have been guest speakers at
for number five.
Yes.
Yeah.
Charlie Munger's quote there was, "Investing in business success is about ignorance removal," which I think overall is just don't invest in things you don't understand.
Correct. That's exactly what I was about to say. I mean, ignorance doesn't mean that you have to know everything because you're never going to.
Mm-hmm.
No one does. But it does mean that if you're completely ignorant about something, then don't invest.
Right. And that's been their philosophy forever.
Yeah.
And that's why Warren Buffett has never picked a tech stock to invest in. I think he's got a few that have morphed Correct. Into technology companies, but they've never picked a tech stock because he doesn't understand it.
Right.
Well, stick around. When we get back, we are going to talk a little bit about the housing market. And if any of these things we're talking about, if you want more clarity, any topics you have heard us talk about, or if you're listening for the first time, you can go to our website, theportfoliodoctors.com. There is some information there that is very pertinent to us and in the future of our show, as this will be our last show on ESPN today. But you can reach out to us also, 858-764-7250. Once again, 858-764-7250. You are listening to The Portfolio Doctors, ESPN 1700. Welcome back. You're listening to The Portfolio Doctors, ESPN 1700. My name is Dan Osgood.
I'm Steve Bick.
And the housing market, we've talked about this a number of times, and it a growing housing market is mandatory for a growing economy. It's the leading portion of it and the strength behind any economic recovery. If you look at the history of all the recessionary periods and difficult economic times, the housing market always leads it out. And Derek and I talked about this just a little earlier today, but there's a lot of info out there about housing and whether it's a justified increase that we've been seeing, or if we're in for a slowdown, good times, bad times. What are your thoughts?
Well, obviously everyone needs a place to live. So that's the premise behind housing. That's why it needs to grow, and people either need to rent a place or you know, buy a place. Whether it's an investor or whether someone's buying it, right? You build it and normally someone buys it and then you rent it or you live in it. So it doesn't really matter whether it's an investor or whether it's the consumer that buys the house. That's the premise.
Mm-hmm.
But behind all of that, you need to have a growing demographic trend, right? And I've discussed this with you at length, where right now the United States' birth index is 1.7.
Right.
You need 2.1 equals a 2.1 number means that you're basically replacing the population that you have. Okay. Two people born and two people die.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you need more than 2.1. 1.7 means you're actually contracting.
So I need to have 0.1 more kids?
You do, Jeff.
You need to have 1.1 more.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Right. ain't gonna happen. But so if we're growing smaller in terms of a population, and of course there's immigration and things like that that keep us in terms we are slowly growing, but mm-hmm. not anywhere near to what we used to, there really isn't that need to continue to build places.
As many homes, right.
There is a need to build houses because they get old and they fall down and you need to redo them, or you knock them down and put them in.
So it's more rebuild than new construction.
So to me, that long-term trend that we've had in place since the 1900s or whatever, that trend is sort of getting a little bit long in the tooth. Those days, people having 4 or 5 children, you know, big families were all of the norm. You know, nowadays, tons of people just have one kid. Right. A lot don't have any. I mean, with this new economy has come the level that we've been talking about in terms of inflation rates. It's become a new level of thought on having kids and the cost of those kids and what you can provide for them. And I think it's just with an added level of intelligence, people are just looking around going, you know, a huge family really isn't the way to go.
Right.
Now, you know, I love my son and, you know, I wouldn't want anything different in that regard. But if the thought of having 4 kids now, wow, you must be nuts. How am I going to support all of those people? I mean, I could support them, sure. I could put them in, you know, put them in normal, you know, public schooling, and I just wouldn't pay for their future educational requirements when they go to universities. Right. And, you know, but that versus now I could do private schooling and I can pay for university education. And to me, it's the one versus the other. It's sort of not worth it. To me, it's almost, and this is just my view, so no one take this out of anything but my view. I just feel that, you know, for the way I look at life, is it's a little bit selfish. If I wanted 4 or 5 kids and I couldn't afford them, I'm just having them because I want more kids.
Right.
It's more like I want some more playthings around the house type idea versus if I want to really do the best that I can possibly for my son, then one of the ways to do that is maybe not have more kids.
Right. And it's kind of similar when you see like the enormous amounts of debt people accumulate.
Yeah.
There's some similarities with what you're talking about is people aren't paying attention or caring. It's if you're carrying a high amount of debt and there's something new you want to go buy, you probably shouldn't, because debt does, just because you can afford to pay that credit card bill that's growing and pay that minimum payment doesn't mean you can afford to buy a new item, because it's only going to make your payment go up by a small amount. And you see that where people, maybe they are being a little bit selfish and saying, well, gee, I'm just going to go buy this new car and because they have this special offer out and I can afford this $150 payment for the next 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very similar to what you're saying, and that's in itself creates these other problems where these people get in these bad positions, file bankruptcy, which is a burden on these companies that have issued this credit for you.
Correct.
It's now all of a sudden that it's in good faith that you're going to pay it back, and now you're going to walk away from it.
So if you think about it, if we're not growing in terms of a population, and that's becoming more of the norm, and it's not just the U.S., it's Europe is the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Japan's the same. China's got a policy they've changed it now.
They just changed because they need...
It was a one-child policy.
And why did they change it? They need more boys or more girls? They were
having
a shortage,
they've got no girls.
Okay.
Because everyone wanted the family name to continue. Right. But I mean, the whole world is slowly getting to a point outside of Africa and places like that. The developed world is slowing down in terms of growth. So if you're looking towards a demographic style trend, and that's a secular trend, a long-term trend, this isn't something you turn around in an afternoon. You have to look at those types of things. And so housing will probably continue to grow, but I just don't see it being the stalwart of the economy,
right.
You know, because of that demographic trend. It's the same thing when you look at stocks that are maybe selling diapers and things like that. I mean, in Japan right now, there's more old people diapers sold than there are baby diapers.
Wow.
And so those are types of trends that you can start seeing. And then the other problems that come along with it is like Social Security. Who's going to fund that for the people that are retiring? And all these other issues coming along with a slower demographic trend. And that's why for me, housing, I like housing. I mean, I think that it's a good investment most of the time, but you just have to be more careful now, I think.
And with that, with just about any type of investment opportunity, it's going to vary from region to region because...
That's the next point, exactly.
Southern California probably is not going to experience the same thing that maybe Middle America or other parts of the country are going to experience when it comes to this decreasing demographic as much, because this is still a very desirable place to be. Although with our current politicians and the tax rates, maybe people are going to get tired of it, and that's going to affect it as well. But there are going to be these areas that are always going to be hot pockets where people want to move there, whether it's because of industry or just because of the climate, whatever it is, there are going to be reasons where housing is going to continue to lead in that specific area.
Right.
But you can't make that blanket statement across the entire country that it is going to be the leader.
No, I mean, exactly right. And if you just take it in terms of just San Diego or Southern California, I mean, I would say housing's still going to be really robust and strong anything west of the I-5, you know. But once you go out towards the desert regions, you start questioning like a Riverside. Now, I'm not saying Riverside's a bad investment per se, but I'm just saying, would you rather live on the beach or would you rather live in Riverside?
Right.
And if things are slowly contracting, then maybe that's a situation where that's not such a good investment versus the other one. And those are just types of demographic type things and geographical ideas that you need to keep in mind when you start looking at this. But back to your point, Dan, I think that housing has hit some issues. I mean, the prices have gone up really quickly. The idea was initially all the investors step in, they did. They drove the housing prices back up. They were already low. They got cheap money. I mean, what a great deal. Now you're seeing it slow down because the consumer's still saddled with debt. I think that I read, you know, in an article you gave me earlier on today that we're at $63 trillion in debt in this country, total government and consumer. And that's an all-time high. Yay. We, you know, so much for paying all our bills. Admittedly,
it's not just the stock market that's hitting all-time highs.
Yeah. Admittedly, a big chunk of that is the U.S. government that's piled $4 or $5 trillion on or whatever they've done. But the other side is the consumer. And there's a lot of second trust deeds and things like that. There's still tons of people underwater on their houses from the good old days, right. You know.
Well, there's still plenty of foreclosure situations and short sale situations happening today. It's
correct.
Just the percentages have dropped enough to where
it's
not leading the market as far as houses that are for sale anymore, which is a good sign.
Right.
But there are still plenty of those cases out there.
But, I mean, the thought of saying we should return to a 70% home ownership level is just sort of asinine, really, because there's no jobs, there's high unemployment, there's slow job growth, there's slow wage growth. You know, so it's, where is this supposed to come from? Why do, you know, people are sort of waking up to the fact, I don't want another massive mortgage. And so I think that this home ownership trend is going to be probably stuck around the 60 to 65% level. And in all reality, that's probably a normal level. I mean, 70 is just ridiculously high.
That's one of, and we talk about this all the time, the percentages and all these numbers that government entities or surveys come up with, they're not necessarily very accurate because you just look at whatever the equilibrium. There's always going to be a percentage of people that are renting, period, for one reason or another. Maybe they're only going to be somewhere for a short period of time. It would not make sense at all to try to buy a house to turn around and sell it 6 months later or a year later. Those numbers are, there's always going to be a lot of wiggle room in the number that the politicians want to have 70% or 75 or 80 or 100% home ownership because that's the American dream.
Right.
That's just not a feasible number. And the reality
is
the market is pretty good at balancing itself out and finding where it wants to be.
Agreed. And it just take that 70% home ownership, right? That means 30% don't own their home. Okay. Well, you've got basically, if you look at the unemployment rate plus the underemployment rate, you're still at about 12 to 15%.
Mm-hmm.
So there's half of your 30% right there that really can't afford a house. So now you're down to 15% left. Well, you've got a ton of old age, you know, pensioners and people like that in retirement homes and that. That's probably at least 5 or 10% of the population. So there you're at 25 already.
Or those same people that have the fixed income and they know that they can afford rent at an apartment complex or a condo complex for less than $1,000 a month. And that's where they're going to be forever because there's no incentive, no reason for them to go buy a house and deal with the hassles that come along with that.
Correct. So, I mean, just on that back of the envelope, we've worked out there's 25% of the population that we know can't even afford a house right now. So, and all we're talking about is another 10% of people who either can't or don't want to or whatever. And then you haven't even factored into the young demographic of people.
Right.
So the thought of trying to get to 70% home ownership is just ridiculous. Not going to happen.
Yep. Well, when we come back, we will discuss 7 pieces of information that are very important to investing in your 401k and to know about 401ks. Welcome back. You are listening to the final ESPN 1700 episode of The Portfolio Doctors. If you want to learn more, go to our website, theportfoliodoctors.com. You can also email Steve or I. Mine is Dan with a D-A-N, not Stan, at theportfoliodoctors.com, and that is plural, theportfoliodoctors.com, or you can reach Steve at theportfoliodoctors.com.
That's not Stan either.
That's not Stan. It starts with an S and a T, but you're missing some of the others. There's a topic here that I think it's very important. Most people have access to a 401k with most businesses. Most businesses have something like that for their employees. There's a lot of gray area. You always see people are contributing, but they're just randomly setting up, oh, I'll just do 5% in all the options or 10% in all the options, and I think that's good. Or they'll watch what happens in the market and see what did best last year and change all the percentages and invest in the highest flying from last year, and typically that doesn't work out well 2 years in a row. But there's a couple tips here. 7 things I wish people knew about 401k plans. Mm-hmm. And the first one is you can do a rollover when you leave. And this is an important one because typically you're very limited in the choices you have in a 401k plan.
What's a rollover?
That's where you take the money from that 401k plan, open an IRA account somewhere else, so a retirement account somewhere else, and take that money and move it into the retirement account. If you move it into any ordinary account, then you create tax consequences. You would have to pay ordinary income tax.
So you roll it over to another retirement account.
Right. So it's keeping it categorized as retirement money, so the IRS allows it to grow tax deferred.
Okay. So you roll it over.
And then that opens up the entire universe of investment options for you, which is very important because as good as a lot of 401k plans are, typically the investments are a little more expensive than you can get on the outside. And because they're limited to 10 or 15 choices, they don't always have the best choices available to you, where there's a lot of things outside that you can do much better for yourself with. Second being automated portfolios work. And that's like the target date fund. So if you know if you're 40 and you're going to retire at 65, there might be a target date of 25 years. You invest the money and in theory, they invest it with more risk now and slowly becoming less risky for you. They don't work exactly as advertised. However, I think this is better than unless you're going to spend the time to educate yourself and make good decisions for what you're trying to do. This is a better solution than just randomly guessing and hoping that you're doing the right thing by just doing that blanket. Okay, 100% of my money, there's 10 funds, 10% in all of them, everything's good. Because then you're setting yourself up for a big problem. If right near retirement, a bad year comes along and you get wiped out, 40%'s gone, this fund should technically be much more conservative in the last couple of years. And if the market does go down, you're not going to lose as badly.
Have they proven any of that?
This is a tough one because overall, if I was going to say outside of a plan like this, if this was a choice, I would say don't do it. Because you can speak with an advisor and get good advice, hopefully, and develop a portfolio specific for you. But like I said, unless you're going to spend the time to really educate yourself, this is a pretty good fallback option. Because
it's one up from just dumping it in the market and walking off.
It definitely, because there is a manager overseeing this fund and managing it according to the time horizon that's stated.
I think that the issue for me on that is now what you've got is you've got a situation of if it does go awry, it's like, oh, well, I'm the same as everyone else.
Right.
We all went down together. Mm-hmm. Well, if that's your how you want to handle it, then that's fine. But then you probably don't have to listen to our show, right?
Correct.
Because that's not what we're after. We're trying to educate you and tell you to not be like everyone else and try and make better decisions and therefore try and improve your returns.
Right.
But anyway.
And some 401k plans actually have like an automated tool that you can go in and answer some questions mm-hmm. and get a risk tolerance idea of what a portfolio should look for like for you. And that tool, that automated tool, will actually create a portfolio design for how you answer those questions, which would be a little more like working with an outside advisor and having him create something for you. Okay. So that can be a good solution as well if that's available within your 401k. Stable value funds are a good choice. We've talked about these as a cash vehicle. This is a fund where they will guarantee some type of minimum rate of return. So in difficult times, they do really well. In very good times, they're not going to do as well, but it's mm-hmm. a nice safety feature to know that you're going to get some type of return. This is kind of a big one people don't really understand. Age 55 is special when it comes to 401k plans. Most people think if you take a withdrawal from a 401k plan before 59 and a half, that magical retirement age, mm-hmm. you have a 10% penalty for withdrawing any money on top of the ordinary taxes. It's not completely true for 401k plans. There is a special provision. 401k plans, if you leave your employer after you reach age 55, but before you reach age 59 and a half, the rule will allow you to withdraw money that's exempt from the penalty. You're still going to pay ordinary income taxes. There's never going to be a way out of that.
Right.
But you don't have to pay that 10% penalty. And that's a nice one. That is a feature that has to come from the 401k. So you couldn't do that rollover into an IRA and still have that provision available to you. That's offered through the 401k. So that's a reason to leave it if you do leave a company and you're older than 55.
Okay.
Fifth one, you have creditor protection. So in a 401k, if you have money in there and you're filing bankruptcy, you've got someone suing you, this is money that's untouchable.
What happens in divorce?
It depends on the agreement, the terms of the divorce, but in many cases, they'll just split it.
The 401k?
Right, the 401k. A retirement account will be set up for the benefit of the spouse. The money will be split, and it'll be held as a retirement account. Designated Roth accounts are great. We've talked about this. That becomes non-taxable money. You're contributing after-tax money, so you get paid your check, the taxes come out, and then your percentage goes into the 401k. It's coded as a Roth. And then when you withdraw it at retirement, you never have to pay a penny on taxes. So it could grow from $100 to $100 million over your career, and you would never pay a penny of taxes on that money, which is relatively new, but a great, great idea. Then the last one, it pertains to some Qualcomm-type people with a lot of these employee stock purchase programs. There are special tax treatments called net unrealized appreciation. That's a complicated thing. I would recommend if you're in a situation where you have these stock option programs, talk to your CPA and see if you're eligible for net unrealized appreciation.
You've got time, Chip. You can explain that.
Yeah, not a chance. It's a tax thing. I'm not a tax expert. I can identify if there's a tax problem, but I'm going to refer you to a CPA every time to make sure you get the right advice. Well, that just about does it for us here.
Yeah, there we go.
We have enjoyed. Steve, you got 5 books sitting in the corner here.
Sure.
With this being our last show, last time we're going to have this offer. Anyone interested in Steve's book, How to Thrive in the Obama Economy, give us a call, 858-764-7250, or
and
email
speak
us.
Speak very clearly.
Yeah, speak clearly. At least give us your phone number clearly. We'll give you a call.
Right.
The first 5 people that contact us, you can email us, dan@theportfoliodoctors.com or steve@theportfoliodoctors.com. Go to our website, find out what's happening in our world, and also access our podcast from past shows. Taylor, thank you very much. You've been outstanding helping us through this, our entire career here at ESPN. Much appreciated. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Have a great long Memorial weekend.
You've been listening to The Portfolio Doctors on ESPN 1700. To schedule a financial health check, go to theportfoliodoctors.com, or to speak with Dan Osgood, Steve Bick, or any guests on this program, call 858-764-7250. That's 858-764-7250, or go online at theportfoliodoctors.com. That's theportfoliodoctors.com. The Portfolio Doctors are Dan Osgood and Stephen Bick, who are investment advisor representatives of their respective registered investment advisor firms, ACAS LLC and Cottingham Management Company LLC. The opinions expressed by the Portfolio Doctors and guests on this radio show are their own and do not reflect the opinions of this radio station. All statements and opinions expressed are based upon information considered reliable, although it should not be relied upon as such. Any statements or opinions are subject to change without notice. Information presented is for educational purposes only. Moreover, no listener should assume that any discussions or information presented serves as the recipient of or a substitute for personalized advice from ACAS LLC, Cottingham Management LLC, or from any other investment professional, and is not intended as an offer of solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. ACAS LLC and Cottingham Management LLC are not law or accounting firms, and no portion of this presentation should be interpreted as legal, accounting, or tax advice. Information expressed does not take into account your specific situation or objectives and is not intended as recommendations appropriate for any listener. Listeners are encouraged to seek advice from a qualified tax, legal, or investment advisor to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation.